Welcome to the Big Mike Fun Podcast, where you learn about advanced wealth building strategies from real estate investing to creating massive ROI and secure retirement profits. So pour yourself a cup of coffee, grab a notepad, and lean in. Because Big Mike has got the mic, starting now.
Welcome to the Big Mike Fun Podcast. I'm the Big Mike.
Mike Zlatnik, and today it is my pleasure and a privilege to welcome back for the episode 2 of this spring 2024 recording, Fernando Angelucci. Hey, Fernando.
Hey, Mike. Thanks for having me back.
Yeah, thanks for coming back on a podcast. Previous discussion went really well. We talked about international situation, how you are in South America. You've traveled the world. You look at storage in other parts of the world. You've seen inflation being way higher than the U.S., and then now let's come back to the U.S. experience in the self-storage industry. This is kind of your bread and butter. So, in the world outside of the U.S., use of storage is a lot lower demand versus where U.S. is at. U.S. is almost unique. A lot of international investors, they come into the U.S. and they're surprised how widely storage is used. Is this a trend that's increasing, or is this sort of a stable trend at this point in the U.S.? Is the demand per capita, 3-mile radius, 5-mile radius, 1-mile radius, in most markets stable? Or is there a pattern change? And again, self-storage is in the business of change, right? People move when something happens. But the moving has been somewhat slower in this environment. When the interest rates spike, people don't move as much. So I'm just curious, what's happening right now?
Yeah, so we're continuing to see a trend of more and more people using storage. Just a couple of years ago, it was at about 1 in every 11 people use storage. Now we're at about 1 in 9, and we see that growing. And that's because of a few things. It's not only just because we're in the moving business, as you say, but now you're starting to see a change in demographics. So, for example, the millennials, they don't want to live in the suburbs away from the action. They want to be downtown where the nightlife and the entertainment is. And in those areas, you have much higher rents per square foot for, say, an apartment building. So instead of opting to go for a 3-bedroom apartment, they go for a 2, or opting to go from a 2 to a 1, and then using storage almost as if it's like an external closet. And we're starting to see that more and more. As rents become less affordable in these larger kind of class A markets, we're starting to see more use, as opposed to it being more of a, you know, temporary moving type situation or something that's caused on a life change. It truly is being used almost as an external closet. So it's a more stable use. These are the tenants that typically stay for 3, 5, 10 years. The other side of that generational gap or that divide, you have people on the older end of the spectrum. So you have baby boomers, you have the silent generation, you have people that nowadays are, you know, almost 15,000 people a day are retiring and downsizing. So what are they doing? They're going from those, you know, 3-4-bedroom ranch houses in the suburbs, and they're either moving into, say, a 1 or 2-bedroom condo, or if they're on the older side of that gap, they may be moving into nursing homes or assisted living facilities, active living facilities, communities. So what we're seeing is a downsizing, but these people don't want to get rid of their things, and they don't want to, the kids don't want them. So that's very interesting. We started to see actually a trend in assisted living facilities requiring that you have a self-storage lease prior to moving in, because if anything happens and you're unable to pay the monthly room rent, they have the ability to sell off your home to pay any deficiencies in your payment for that room rent. So it's been a very interesting trend. Now, that's just as a whole across the United States in general, on a more macro trend. When you look at the most previous 6 to 12 month period, you do see somewhat of a slowing down from the COVID and pandemic, you know, hot boom. During that time, you had people having to work from home, or the kids having to go to school from home. So, you know, they had to turn that second or third bedroom into a office or into a school area for their children. And that caused over the last 2 years, storage to go up over 80% year over year in rents. And that was, you know, pretty crazy. We were seeing stabilized vacancies at sub 6%, which is we've never seen in the industry before. And now we're starting to get a cooling off from that now, people returning to work, people going back to school. So for example, one of the larger technology providers in the space that has data on over 1,000 facilities, they did a quick report at this most recent Self-Storage Association spring conference showing that the stabilized vacancies have now dropped to close to 84% occupancy with the, you know, a 14 to 16% vacancy rate as now the kind of stabilized trend. And that's kind of where it was prior to the pandemic, you know, 2019, beginning of 2020. So we're seeing a reversion to the mean, if you will. At the same time, you were starting to see a lot of projects coming online from these, you know, these ground up developments that were in process that take 18 months to 24 months to go through zoning and entitlements, another 12 months to actually develop and get certificate of occupancy. And now those projects that were still in that, you know, 0% to 2.5% Fed fund rate projects are now starting to hit the market. And in some areas that had a very large population increase during the pandemic, like the South and the Southeast, we're starting to see oversaturation in those markets. That coupled with, of course, you see problems with hurricanes coming through, hitting Florida. We saw over 6 insurance providers leave that state, which started to make a lot of our ground-up developments in that state unfeasible. We actually canceled 4 of our large projects there because we went from a 35 to 50,000 projected premium per year up to, in some cases, up to 170,000 just on the insurance premium alone. That coupled with the banks, as we talked about on the previous podcast, the banks really tightening up because of the, you know, the alleged runs on the banks that they were seeing in the future. A lot of these banks were holding sub 1% treasuries, and they were worried that if they had to liquidate those, they'd be, you know, massively in the red. Fortunately, the Fed created a program where you'd be able to put up those assets at par value, and it was a 1-year loan. Then again, that was extended for another year. We'll see if it gets extended for a third year. And that allowed the banks to now start to back off of the crazy underwriting assumptions they had. Like we said on the previous podcast, I had deals where just in November of 2023, October to November of 2023, I was getting offers in the 43 to 47% leverage range, where they were underwriting my project at an 8.5% or 9% interest rate plus a 1% stress test. And they would stress the DSCR up to 1.4. And these were on some projects that even had cash flow coming in day one. So now we're starting to see the bank start to calm down a little bit. Just last week, we've already received a few term sheets on some projects we have ongoing, and they're underwriting back to a 1.2 debt cover. There's no stress test. The rate has now dropped to, I'm starting to see in the 6.5 to 7.5 range, as opposed to 8.5, 9% that I was seeing literally just 6 months ago. So it seems that the banks are starting to feel more confident that we're not going to have some type of run on the bank across the economy due to what have you, a recession at the, you know, at the Wall Street level, if you will. So those are kind of some of the trends that we're noticing right now.
Thanks, Fernando. That's a lot to unpack. Appreciate you sharing this. So I'll go back to the first common big cities, people using storage as an extra closet. Certainly seeing it. I mean, New York City, you see the self-storage popping up as a way to get an extra room where you don't have the extra room. And as rents climb and per square foot for residential, it's cheaper to get storage. So agreed on that, on that concept. That trend is probably fundamentally solid in big cities. And also supply is also limited. Where do you build them? So it's just there's no, you know, there's no room to build. But let's go back to the most recent developments where the banks are lightening up a little bit on the underwriting, which is definitely helpful because experience of purchase of or refi heavily depends on the bank, how tight the credit is, and the credit is too tight. none of the projects pencil. Very interesting commentary. Well, it's a well-known commentary. The entire industry has been hit. So we've obviously hit the higher for longer rates. We've also hit these insurance premiums going through the roof. It's another sort of unexpected, like a black swan event that doesn't happen often. And it's like a massive tidal wave that hit everyone at the same time, and it continues to hit. So the new development projects are stalled. People just not writing, they don't pencil any longer. But the previous ones that were originated now coming into the supply. So it's actually exacerbating the problem because supply is coming in. Demand, like you said, I love the term reversion to the mean on the overall demand. And the 85% occupancies, from what I learned years ago, is the standard for the self-storage industry. So if you were in the 90s, that was above the average. And certainly some facilities can operate, but it's a local dynamic. So yeah, all this stuff is telling me something interesting. It's telling me some kind of slow returns on self-storage projects for a while, right? Just all the forces that are there make it less attractive to write a fresh check unless you get some phenomenal deal from some crazy motivated seller. Are you seeing anything like that, or it's a slow, patient game?
Yeah, so you know, we usually will break apart the storage industry into existing assets that are already producing cash flow and then assets that are not producing cash flow. And that could either be a lease up project or even a ground up development project. So where we have been seeing deals coming into the market now are those where they do not have existing cash flow in place, because then the bank looks at that as a much riskier asset and the terms are much tighter. So we are seeing some, I wouldn't say fire sales, but much more motivated sellers for those types of assets than even 18 months ago. Where we are seeing those types of deals pencil out.
Sorry, I'm just going to jump in. Somebody built a facility. It's empty. Lease up is slow. And they're out of cash. They're stressed because they took variable rate debt. Now the debt is squeezing them. They have to sell. Maybe you can get a pretty good discount on the property because it's not, you know, needs to go to lease up. Is that what you're
exactly
saying?
Yeah. So, you know, when we first came into the industry years ago, it was not uncommon to see someone sell a certificate of occupancy project with 0% occupancy for close to what that asset would go for at stabilization. Those times are long gone. Now what we're seeing is, again, to the term that you like, reversion to the mean. Now those developers that are selling those CO projects, they're going back to the, you know, cost plus 20% is what's pretty standard now in that side of the world. And that's what it was like prior, you know, to this 0% Fed rate policy. The other place that we're seeing these types of deals pencil is when you decide to, instead of bringing a ton of demand into the market right off the bat, you phase that demand in. Or that supply in. So instead of trying to build 80 to 100,000 square feet of storage day one, you get a little bit more land than what you'd usually need. And then you build 30,000 square feet first. And then you put a building behind that. Once that one is stabilized, then you put another 30,000 square feet behind that. And then another 30,000 square feet behind that. And that allows you to use your equity that you're building in that first phase or that second phase to then build the second and the third phase without having to go back and issue a capital call to your investors. So we've seen that strategy working out quite a bit. But like you said, there are some people that are in big trouble right now because not only did they take variable rate debt, but they took short-term debt as a bridge, a, you know, 2 year, 24-month loan to get from construction to, you know, CO with maybe a little bit of lease up. And now they're finding that they're not at the values they need to refinance out and they have to fire sell the property. So we are on the lookout for those types of deals.
So yeah, that's it hit multifamily industry. And now what you're telling me, it has hit obviously storage, because anytime you do construction, it is a value add, because it's a value add. The only debt was available floating rate debt. There was no other way. And then those loans are maturing, the rate is up a lot, and these projects are in financial pressure. Similar to some of the multifamily projects, it's a terrible situation, but that's where you see a distress when they finish the project, and if they don't sell it, they got to raise a lot of capital, otherwise they can't keep the lights on, they can't get the project to the finish line. And on top of that, some of them have been budgeted based on old insurance premiums, right? So you finish the facility, insurance is much higher, so your monthly burn is way higher. So another
not
issue,
only that, but also market rents. What we're seeing across the board right now
it's softening
is,
up. Market rents are softening up.
yeah, because it's not only what people are willing to pay, but the larger operators, the REITs, publicly traded REITs, they value occupancy over net operating income because they have longer term capital. So what they're doing, for example, Extra Space, they cut rates 35% across the board for street rates. So if you're a project in that area that is competing
Hold the
against a
horses here. Extra Space, one of the largest REITs, they cut the rates where? Every market or across the board? Everywhere out of the country?
When they were talking at the annual conferences, they said, "Hey, we're aggressively cutting rates up to 35% across the board to stay occupied and make sure that no one steals occupancy from us." And the reason for this is pretty simple in storage. Storage is a highly sticky asset. So if you can get the person into the facility at a lower rate, then you have an aggressive increasing of that rate over a 12 to 18 month period where then you get them to what was your market rate originally. And usually the especially for the smaller units, the friction of moving usually is not worth it over an extra 10, 15, $30 a month in rent. And then you just take that rent hit, that rent increase. So that's a problem though, if you're coming into the market with fresh supply, because now you have an empty facility, you're competing against a facility that's full that is willing to cut rates so that you can't steal occupancy from them.
That's an interesting point. Literally last week we had a panel of experts, and you should be on a panel. So I mean this with all due respect. I had a couple of other guys in storage. You know those guys, Jake and Scott. So Jake Vanderslice and Scott Myers. So you know those guys. They're like you. They've been in storage for many years. They're experts like you. So one of the things that I heard on the panel is that a lot of big REITs are offering massive incentives to move in. So your normal rate, $200 a month, you get a special no rent for 3 months or some crazy. Like basically, these incentives are absolutely, like you said, effective rate cut is like 35%, but they don't do it in the form of a rate cut. They're giving them big incentives to move in and I guess to stay, maybe something like that. Are you seeing that? Is it the same behavior where the small guys are taking it into a battlefield where the big players are very aggressive on their pricing side to motivate people to stick with their product?
We're seeing on both sides. So not only just a true, hey, the rent was 200, now it's 140. We've seen that. We've also seen the massive incentives, 50% off for 6 months, or your first month and your last 2 months are $0, right? Or $1. So we've seen it both, but as an average, it comes out to about a net effect of about 30, 35% decrease in incoming street rates, which makes it difficult for incoming lease up projects to lease up quickly.
Wow, that is gigantic. I mean, I don't know how to put it. It is for fresh capital, you could get, obviously, you could try to get much better deals. If you could steal these built for certain cost facilities, then you come in and you lowball offer them based on new higher insurance and new cost of money and everything else. So fresh capital, much greater deal. Existing deals, I'm very concerned about NOI drops, right? If you have to stay afloat because it's both a beauty and a curse of the self-storage industry. The monthly rent, it's a beauty because when things are good, you can bump rents up a lot. But it's a curse if you have to start cutting just to stay competitive with the big, big competitors, CubeSmart, Life Storage, a number of other shops. So you see valuation corrections significant as a result, because NOIs are falling, insurance is up, cost of money is up. Revenues are down because of this competitive pressures. Probably a lot of pain, right? I mean, am I reading it wrong?
So again, we split the market into properties that are already cash flow positive after debt service and properties that are not. So the ones that are not, those are the ones that are feeling a lot of pressure, a lot of pain. But for example, for us in the last 18 months, when we've got to the part where we are now in the economy, the deals that we're going after, majority now are deals that have existing cash flow, that cash flow after debt service day one. And those types of sellers are not feeling much pain because they say, why should I sell when I have long-term fixed rate debt? I could just keep collecting the cash flow until the market comes back to a place where I'm liking the valuations, right? So on that side of the world, it is a little bit harder to get good deals because of the prices that those sellers are expecting, coupled with where new debt is, but they themselves are not feeling much pain. The way that we've been getting around that is now moving to typically, you know, we were talking about the Volcker years. One type of strategy that was used a lot during that time was seller finance or creative financing. And we're starting to see a lot of that come back now. You know, prior to 18 months ago, if you were to make an on-market offer through a broker and even mention, even whisper the words creative financing or seller financing, they wouldn't even present your offer to the seller. It just didn't make sense. But now, because they know, you know, we usually don't buy a lot of stuff on market. Almost 90% of what we buy is off market. But nowadays, we're seeing brokers reaching out to us saying, hey, Fernando, Steven, we know that you guys know how to structure creative offers where we can get to that price where that seller is willing to sell. But in the end of the day, it all pencils out to the same way as if you got your price and you got bank debt. And so that's the thing that we always try to explain to other people that we're teaching how to do this is the price really doesn't matter. What matters is the price plus the amount of interest that you pay over your projected hold period. So if you can adjust the amount of interest that you would have paid if you bought at your price with bank debt, you can still pay the seller's price, but with them carrying the debt at the interest that you need so that your total project cost, including interest over the hold period, is the same as it was if you went with bank debt.
Yeah, love it. Back to the past, the seller finance concept, I don't know how you can you also do assumable. So obviously seller finance is the right. And then assumable, if they've got a good fixed rate debt and they want to sell somehow now, you can wrap around and assume and at least have that experience of low interest rate cost versus what the market offers today. I mean, that's been a discussion in multifamily too, but you're right. Without creating financing, either a wrap or seller finance, the math just doesn't work. You can't pay them the price that they want. Otherwise, you need a steeper discount.
Correct.
So it's kind of a trade-off. Is it the cash price or a payment term price, right? That's what you're describing.
We always joke around. It's you can have your price and it's my terms, or it's my price and your terms. And your terms are usually that you want cash right now, right? So there's always, like you said, there are those structures where some owners have some good perm debt that is assumable. Typically, that's going to be your CMBS or your LifeCo money. But then there's also these banks that are not assumable. And if the bank finds out that there is a wrap around their, you know, mortgage one, they will trigger a due on sale clause.
Yeah, because they loan the money at 4%. Now they can charge a lot more of the hell. I mean, they'll call the note.
Right. So one of the ways that we're getting around those non-assumable kind of aggressive due on sale clauses is to structure a master lease with an option to purchase at the end of. So it looks like seller finance, it smells like seller finance, but in the eyes of a bank, it's not. You have a lease option that you pay up front. That lease option will go towards the purchase option at the end of the 5 years, however you structure it. And then you pay a fixed lease fee to lease the self-storage facility, and then you get to run the operations. It's basically the equivalent of a interest-only debt, but you don't have the issues with that due on sale clause from a bank that is, you know, they don't want to participate in a structure that way.
Yeah, that's a very powerful technique. The master lease has been used in commercial real estate many times, and mm-hmm. it definitely gets used on larger projects. And then the lessee can sublease, and that's a very simple, clever way to get around due on sale. So it's it makes a lot of sense.
Right.
So let's continue to kind of analyze this. And like you said, it's a very bifurcated experience. Those who have fixed rate debt, and same is true with multifamily, any asset mm-hmm. class. If you've got fixed rate debt and you don't have a term cliff, term maturity, or you don't have floating rate debt, and you're generating positive cash flow, you're sitting relatively pretty. Of course, if you start losing a little bit of occupancy with doing competitive pressure and some, you have to make some adjustments. You may have to
Correct.
battle the competition, but at least you have some runway with fixed rate debt. So kind of interesting. And are you seeing great opportunities today on the new buy? And a new buy, obviously, you got to get deep enough discount to account for all the risk. Your financing options are much worse, right? You have longer lease up, more difficult lease up, more competitive pressures, and the returns on fresh money have to look more attractive. So if you don't
Right.
get good enough price, so how much of a discount are we talking about? Let's get specific. Somebody built a facility, and I remember this, like you said, just a few minutes ago. You would build and sell without full lease up for almost the price at the end of stabilization. These were gigantic upside. And I don't know what's even the cost plus works, because if a seller is distressed, doesn't matter, right? I mean, there's a squeeze. It doesn't matter what they paid for construction, doesn't matter all this stuff. What matters is what they can get for it today. So give me some examples. What are you seeing out there on this brand new build facility? Is this 20% discount? Is this higher? Is this lower? How much? And I'm just curious, from the peak, obviously, because we have to go back from the
Right.
point where it traded at a high price and now it's retreating. What kind of discount are we talking about?
Yeah, so it's hard to put an average discount because obviously storage is one of those market by market asset types. And when I say market, I mean a 3 to 5 mile radius, not a city or a part of a city. So where we're coming in is usually, we want to be able to see a 1.3 debt cover within 24 months of buying that asset. And if we can't get to that number, we have to keep pushing that price down until it gets to that 1.3 debt cover. So, I mean, we've had offers all over the board. We've had offers that were at, cost plus 20 at kind of the high end, which is kind of standard nowadays. And then all the way down to a 30% discount on cost, which obviously the sellers did not want to take because they just spent 14 months building out this asset. And now I'm telling them that, they
Gotta
spent
take a massive
14
haircut with all
million in
that
my
money.
offers at 11 and a half, right? 12 million for that asset. So we're not really focusing on those assets right now because I don't want to fight the banks. There is an opportunity there, but I'm going to work with where the easy money is. And the easy money is assets that already have cash flow positive after debt service. But the niche that I'm seeing here is kind of mixing a little bit of both. I'm going after assets that it's already stabilized, it already has, 85 to 90% occupancy. However, that asset comes with additional land that's already zoned for storage. And what I'll do is then I'll expand the asset by 30% at max 50%. So if it's a 50,000 square foot facility, I'll build another 25, maybe 28,000 square feet. That is a much easier sell to the bank because you come in and say, hey, I got an asset that has proven history in this market that there is demand. It is above where it should be if you look at a national average, which means there's pent-up demand. I have land that's already entitled. It's ready to go. All I've got to do is get permits. And during that construction period, the income from the existing facility will cover the additional debt that's needed. So to them, it's a go because not only do they have an asset that's stabilized, but then I'm going to be increasing this asset. And by the time I get stabilization on that additional 30 to 50% in size, they're going to have an asset where the stabilized loan to value is going to be sub 50%. It's hard for a bank to say no to that, right? It's much easier for a bank to say, hey, there's going to be no cash flow. I'm going to need 5 years from you. I'm probably going to need 36 months interest only to make it work with where interest rates are right now. We don't know. There's no historical proof that it's going to work. These are all just projections from feasibility studies, what have you. That's a much harder sell to a bank, especially if you're going towards those kind of local and community banks that are typically going to give you your better style debt, but they are also much more conservative.
Yeah, very interesting focus that you are picking relatively easier targets. So you don't need to get as steep of a discount, but you're still probably looking for some. So what kind of discount are you still looking for on projects like this? So you want expansion, room to expand. You want a room to build additional capacity. When you're buying them, are you trying to lock them in already with a construction loan for additional capacity, or it's more of a, okay, I'll buy, operate for a while and see what happens and build, at the right time?
Yeah, so for example, our most recent syndication that we closed on December 29th of 2023. We bought the facility in cash with a seller finance structure where the seller agreed to take a second position on about, so it was about a $2.3 million purchase. So it was a smaller deal. Seller took an $800K second position seller finance note at 4% interest only for 5 years. That allowed us to go to a bank and say, hey, we don't need much from you. We're looking for a combined loan to value of 68%. The seller is coming in with a 4% debt interest only, which is going to push the DSCR, combined DSCR, way lower than the thresholds than you guys really need. Are you willing to write on this? We're already operating the facility. We've already started putting modular units on the facility. We just need you guys for the construction debt. Is that something you're willing to do? And now we have banks that are coming in and offering us really good terms, anywhere between 6.5 to 7.5, low prepay penalties, and 25-year amortizations, which basically were out the door at the end of last year. Everything was 15s or 20s. And they're giving us 5 years on that construction debt to line up with the seller finance piece that's underlying. So that I'm able to get into those, these types of structures. It's very easy to not have to ask for a 50% discount. So you're most likely going to win that bid when you're competing against other buyers. But at the same time, I could still offer 16 to 22% IRRs to my investors and a 1.8 to a 2.2 equity multiple, which is kind of what we will aim for on these type of purchase plus expansion deals. But we're able to already, investors like stability. They like the ability to start getting distributions early. They don't want to wait 3 to 4 years for a ground up development to start kicking out enough cash flow so they can pay their accumulating pref. So it makes it easier all the way around. It makes it easier from the bank. It makes it easier from the investors. It makes it easier for the seller to accept. It makes it easier for us to buy.
Yeah, I appreciate that. You almost have to focus on income today for investors. It's like the Grove deal's super hard to sell. It's
Right.
the biggest issue is that the seller a really good Grove deal. You don't have stability of data to justify. You either underwriting aggressively, which you can't sell, right? Or if you
Right.
underwrite ultra conservatively, you can't get the deal. You can't buy. So it
Right.
becomes can't transact. So the power of these seller finance deals, you said 4% money at second position, that's ridiculous. We do them as that, 20%, right? If you
Right.
get 4% money, that can make the deal, right? That's the crazy part. Because basically it's near free money, and and you said the bank, they lean the whole asset, but they're only giving you construction money, right?
Right.
Yeah,
Exactly.
so it's super powerful.
And it makes us win these deals, right? I mean, you were talking about, first of all, on the investor side, the cash flow. Prior to this tightening that occurred, when we were raising on growth deals, we were raising about $1 million every 2 to 3 days on our growth deals. Now, a growth deal, if I'm getting $1 million a month, I'm doing good, right? But on the cash flowing deals, those deals are still filling up within 72 hours at max 1 week. I have everything committed. And then I'm also able to go to these sellers and say, listen, this is how I get this that second position construction piece, right? Or that second position seller finance. They say, I have a way that I can offer you more than all of the other buyers that you're talking to are able to offer you. But it's going to take getting a little bit creative. And let me show you how I could protect your investment. So not only am I coming and say, let's, I need you to help me solve your problem so that we can get a structure that makes sense. And I say the only way that I'm going to be able to pay more for your asset than all the other buyers that are competing on this is I have to build. I can't just buy it and operate it the way it is. I have to buy it and I have to expand it. That's the only way I can pay you that price. The unfortunate part is I need to get construction debt for that build out. So the only way that a construction lender is going to come in is if they're in the first position. So that's just number one. You're going to have to be in second position regardless. The second way to get that construction debt very easily is if you help me drop my combined debt service or my combined loan to value. So that means that you're going to have to be in sub market terms for this to work out. But that accomplishes your goal, which is most sellers is I want this price. That's all I'm focused on. I don't care about anything else. I want this price. And if you get me to that price, I don't care how you structure the entire deal, make it work. One of the other things that we've been doing with sellers as well. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, go ahead. So what were you doing with sellers?
So one of the other ways that we've been kind of showing sellers how we are different than other buyers is by actually helping with their tax problem. The interesting thing about storage is over the last 10 to 20 years, people that built these facilities for 25 to 40 bucks a foot, now they're selling them at, 100 to 150, 180 in some cases. They have a massive tax problem because their basis is so low. So we say, hey, not only can you do some seller financing with us where we can drip principal your way, so that way you can kind of spread out your capital gains, but what if you actually come in on the stack with us? So now I'm also converting a part of that seller into an LP, and then I'm pushing all of my bonus depreciation towards that seller so that when they sell to us, yeah, maybe the price is the same as someone else, but the net in their pocket is 20 to 30% higher.
That's pretty cool. That's more creative finance, more bonus depreciation. It makes a lot of sense if you can help them reduce tax liabilities as well as get them. But I'm assuming these are, let's just call them smaller operators. These are, you can't have these conversations with a big operator. So these facilities are what, 20,000-30,000 square feet, even smaller, right?
No, so we're aiming for basically the top of the range prior to REITs getting involved. So basically a facility is going to be worthwhile for a REIT once you can buy it at about 50,000 gross revenue per month, because at that point, third-party management is in line with the percentages that you estimate, usually about 4-5%. Anything below that, then all of a sudden your property management is going to become 8%, 9%, 10% of revenue, right? So our goal is to buy just below that 50,000 gross, but then expand the facility. So then when we go to buy or when we go to sell, then it is an asset that a REIT would want to take down. And that you're allows really us to get a much bigger spread. Assets.
You're not talking about mom and pop facilities, but you're not quite REIT just under, and you can expand and potentially, that's a very interesting strategy.
These are 40 to 60,000 net rentable. So it's not going to be a small deal, because if the deal is too small, getting financing is a pain. But there's just sub REIT, and then we are building them to become a REIT quality asset that we can eventually sell. And then that allows us to make a large spread on the cap rate at purchase and at sale, because when they're buying, they have to deal with people like me that are looking for big discounts. But then when I go to sell, it's really someone that's just buying cash flow because they have quarterly profit expectations that they need to meet on the stock market.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Fernando, this is a lot of great nuggets. Appreciate your wisdom. You certainly got your systems, I don't call it pat down, but you got your niche. You got your pretty cool niche, and you know what you're doing, and you are certainly dealing with these very dynamic marketplace. And in fact, this could create more opportunities, because all this creative finance, everything else, it takes out sort of your standard traditional or typical investors, unless and until they have a certain level of experience, sophistication to structure these deals. It's also, they're big enough where you kind of chime away the really, push away the really small fish, and you become you're the biggest shark in a relatively small pond, but not really small either. So it's kind of a good way to get, I guess, to swim in the
right.
Final question, and we got to wrap up. Markets. So you still, what markets do you like today in storage? Where are you trying to buy? I'm just curious. Is it still Southeast, South, Sun Belt, or are you going somewhere where you don't care, as long as the deal is good?
I'm we market to the lower 48, but we always have the same type of due diligence. It doesn't matter where we are. The areas that have been working recently are going to be your Midwest deals, your Southeast deals, not including Florida. So, North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, Alabama. And then, in the Midwest, you got your Illinois, Ohio, Iowas, your Pennsylvanias. These type of areas are doing really well for us. We're winning some really good deals with some really good spreads on them.
The Midwest, Eddie, you're avoiding the South. I guess Florida is just an insurance situation is completely insane.
It's insane.
So makes sense. Appreciate you sharing. Once again, how would folks get a hold of you? What's the best way to reach out?
So the two easiest ways is the first one, you can call or text me. My number is area code 630-408-8090. Or you can go to our website. It's www.ssse.com.
It's pretty cool. Three S's and an E.com, right?
Correct.
Fernando, appreciate you coming on a podcast episode 2. Enjoy the spring and hope some really interesting deals come your way. So.
Likewise. Talk to you soon, Mike.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Big Mike Fund Podcast. To receive your copy of Mike's How to Choose a Smart Real Estate Fund book, head to BigMikeFund.com or visit Amazon and type Mike's slot name. Keep listening and keep investing Big Mike style. See you on the next episode.